Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. There are a few people I consider more stalwart, more courageous, certainly more visible, and more effective in helping the rest of us understand what that war is about and waging it, at least in the information battle space, than our guest, John Bolton. John is, of course, the former U.S. ambassador, the permanent representative to the United Nations, capping a distinguished career under several administrations in several different agencies. He is the author of the wonderful bestseller, Surrender is Not an Option, a senior fellow of the American Enterprise Institute and a regular at Fox News and periodically here at Secure Freedom Radio. It's always a pleasure. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back. Merry Christmas to you. Happy New Year. And let's talk a little bit about what happened in 2014.
Right. Well, Merry Christmas to you and all your listeners. I'm glad to be with you again, Frank.
Thank you. Let's start maybe with Cuba. The president announced this week that he's going to jettison 50 years of a policy that hasn't worked. Do you agree that it hasn't worked? And what do you make of this policy shift?
No, I think it's been very important to keep Cuba isolated, to make it clear to other countries that if they want to deal with Cuba, they're going to pay a price with the United States. I think this is another piece of evidence of just how ideological a president Barack Obama is, how radical he is. His rhetoric in announcing this policy shift to me sounded like the Fair Play for Cuba Committee from the 1960s. It's been an ideological tick of the left in America that Castro really is not the problem, that the United States is the problem. And the president, as in so many other instances, sees America not as a benign force in the world, but is a big part of the problem. And I'm just worried that what we've seen here with respect to Cuba is just the beginning of a long series of surrenders by the president to our adversaries around the world.
Well, sadly, it's not the beginning so much as it's of a piece with others that he's made, notably to the Muslim Brotherhood and the Russians and the Chinese. But I take your point, and I wonder specifically, Ambassador John Bolton, whether you anticipate, as do I, that what he's done here is probably pretty much the template for what he will do shortly with respect to Iran, even as he enables it to finish its job of getting nuclear weapons.
Yeah, to me, it's only a matter of Iran deciding when they believe they have reaped enough concessions from this administration and you can finally get them to say yes. And I think if I were sitting in Tehran, I'd say our strategy continues to work. We're going to get even more concessions from them. I think the president's looking forward to today where he can have Fidel Castro at lunch at the White House and the Ayatollah Khamenei for dinner.
Or they will be having him for dinner, as the case may be.
Exactly. It's a signal to adversaries and friends alike that if you've got something you want from the United States that you've longed for years or even decades to get, the next 2 years are the time to get it. I am just appalled at this and the vulnerability of our country that it signals.
Let me ask you about a particularly vexing piece of that vulnerability as far as I'm concerned, John Bolton, and that is largely the acquiescence of most in political life. There have been notable exceptions. We've seen, of course, Senator Rubio, Senator Cruz, former Governor Bush, with ties to the Cuban community particularly, expressing strong concern. But there hasn't been actually an embrace of what the president's done on some Republican quarters, notably Rand Paul. It certainly has been the case that there's been acquiescence. Does this bespeak, in your judgment, a lack of national security mindedness, a kind of cluelessness, really, about why this is such a danger to this country?
Well, I think in part it's due to the president's timing, whether it was coincidental or whether he did it deliberately. Congress had left Washington, and so the potential for the members to have an echo chamber was greatly reduced.
Yeah, it's no accident, comrade. I think it's fair to say, John.
I think Senator Rubio, Senator Cruz, as you mentioned, Governor Bush have all spoken up. But I agree with you. I think other Republicans should be speaking up too. And I must say, I'm looking forward to the new intake from the 2014 election to get to Washington. I think we'll have a number of people who campaigned on and who understood that national security had to be raised higher on the list of priorities in the overall national debate. And, you know, the Cuba example, unfortunately, these days is just one of many that shows how vulnerable the United States is. And I think the American people would respond to this. I think it's important for our country, but I think it's good politically, too.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because, of course, you engaged very intensively in the 2014 cycle with your Bolton PAC and Bolton Super PAC. Precisely for this purpose, as I understood it, to raise the visibility of national security, to assist and encourage candidacies that got it. First of all, talk, John, if you would, about your experience in that cycle and how important in the end you thought it turned out to be that national security did matter to the voters decisively in quite a number of cases.
Well, I think it was a very, very important issue. And I think the American people, frankly, are way ahead of their so-called political leaders on this. You know, they actually want the country to be defended, and they want to send people to Washington who are going to be alert to dangers and speak up about them. I think we had an impact in raising this issue several Senate races where we did independent expenditures. Tom Cotton in Arkansas, Tom Tillis in North Carolina, even though Scott Brown lost in New Hampshire. I think that's one reason he came close. Joni Ernst in Iowa. And I think the tragic beheadings of Americans by ISIS really brought home to people that they don't feel secure under this administration. They don't feel secure on the border. They don't feel secure from international terrorism. They don't feel secure from the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And candidates in the House and the Senate who raised these issues succeeded. Most recently, Martha McSally winning in Arizona, a very close race. And in many, many others, too numerous to name here, who I think will come to Washington, who will make national security an issue.
Well, and they'll need encouragement and leadership. And I guess I just wanted to ask John Bolton, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and now senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, also the driving forces you've heard behind Bolton PAC and Bolton Super PAC. What you make of the kind of leadership that we saw out of those who will be, at least nominally, the leaders in the next Congress, whatever the incoming class brings to the party, and I hope you're right that it will be a very robust contribution to be sure, but what do you think of what we saw from John Boehner in the House and Mitch McConnell, now, of course, the minority leader, but soon to be the majority leader, in the Senate on the National Defense Authorization Act, for example, the executive amnesty and whether it was constitutional or really basically foreclosing, for all intents and purposes, the exercise of the power of the purse?
Well, I think that the party as a whole has not done its job. And, you know, I think there are a lot of reasons for that. But it helps contribute to the general mood that national security is not important. The president never talks about it except when he can surrender to somebody or give away American national security interest. And if the Republicans don't call him out on it, the practical American people say, well, if the president's not concerned and the Republicans aren't concerned, I guess I'm not concerned either. At their conclusion is logical but wrong. It is the duty of the Republican Party, which is the national security party, to raise these issues. And we need leaders who feel comfortable talking about the issues. I think especially as we look toward the 2016 presidential election, you know, we've just gone through six and we'll have gone through 8 years of a president who's utterly unqualified on national security grounds to lead the country. The notion that the Republican Party could nominate somebody similar to that just chills me, because if the Republican Party gives up national security leadership, the country is in deep trouble.
Yeah. You've touched on really a very important theme of this program, of course, and I just want to salute you for the seriousness that you have addressed these issues with over your entire career, Ambassador John Bolton, and specifically to pray, really, that your counsel will be very much at the forefront of the thinking of the new Congress, because I couldn't agree with more about both the importance to the country, most importantly, and also to the party of having this be a mainstay. The Peace Through Strength platform is the way I kind of think of it, part of the brand of the Republicans in Congress and elsewhere around this country. And I fear if history has taught us anything, it's when we abandon those principles and those priorities, we don't do well at the poll. John, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you very much again for your service to our country.
Well, thanks again for having me. Merry Christmas.
And to you too, sir. Next up, we'll talk with Luis Fleischman. More on Cuba, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm pleased to say, joined by Luis Fleischman. He is a senior advisor to the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project at our Center for Security Policy. He edits its America's Report. Luis is also an adjunct professor of political science and sociology at the Wilkes Honor College at Florida Atlantic University. His latest book is Latin America in the Post-Chavez Era, The Security Threat to the United States. He's deeply knowledgeable about hemispheric affairs, and it is a privilege to have him work with us at the Center for Security Policy and to join us at this moment, a very, very epical moment, it would appear. Luis Fleischman, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's always good to be here in your program with you.
Well, what makes it epical, of course, is that the president has announced this week that he is reversing 50 years or so of American policy and normalizing relations with Fidel and Raul Castro's Cuba. What is that about, in your estimation, Luis? Why now? And very briefly, what might its implications be?
Well, it's interesting because I've been looking into what kind. I mean, it's not clear what are the details of the agreement. But at this point, we know that in order to lift the embargo on Cuba, we need congressional approval, which is not likely to come. On the other hand, Castro himself, except releasing the 53 prisoners, plus Alan Gross, plus another person, has not given an inch in terms of human rights. And we know that other things have not been negotiated, like, for instance, the fact that Cuba is advising and promoting its own model of socialist dictatorship to other countries, mainly Venezuela, where Cuban advisors are advising mainly in how to establish a totalitarian state.
And providing, as I understand it, Luis Fleischman, the security forces with which the president, Nicolas Maduro, is doing just that. We're visiting with Dr. Luis Fleischman. He is a senior advisor to the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project of the Center for Security Policy. And Luis, you were talking a bit about what the nature of the relationship is between Fidel and Raul Castro's Cuba and the regime of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. Was the fact that Maduro's government and country, for that matter, are basically bankrupt, especially in light of the collapse of oil prices, Do you think these were factors in the decision to move this normalization with the United States along at this time?
It could be. It could be. According to the reports, I mean, there have been 18 months of negotiations, and what we are seeing with the fall of oil prices is taking place right now. So I'm not certain about the connection. But definitely, I believe that Venezuela is less and less a reliable ally because Venezuela cannot provide oil in the same way. Remember, provided 2/3 of the oil that Cuba needs.
At basically, negligible cost as well, right?
Well, almost nothing. Zero. It was in exchange. It was in kind. In exchange for medical advisors and obviously security advisors, but it's called repressive advisors.
Yeah, repressive advisors indeed. Luis Fleischman, let me turn to what this means, if anything, based on, as you say, sort of limited understanding of what we got in the terms of this deal and what might be coming from it. But what do you think this likely portends for the people of Cuba? Is this going to translate, as the Chamber of Commerce and many on the left insist, on a liberalization of the regime just on the basis of greater access to our markets, our tourists, and investment?
There could be a little bit of improvement, but I doubt it. I think one of the myths that, in my opinion, the president helped perpetuate is the idea that the embargo hurt the Cuban economy. The embargo did not hurt the Cuban economy because Cuba was open to every other country in the world except the United States. That means, and what is the excuse of Venezuela that is also going bankrupt and never had an embargo, all right? So the nature of the communist regime that brought Cuba to this kind of situation where they are, of scarcity, of poverty, and so on and so forth. The reality is that foreign investments in Cuba have not worked in Cuba because of the difficulties that exist in Cuba with the communist regime, with the corruption existing there, with the bad laws existing there that are not good for foreign investment. They are not good for any type of private initiative. So I believe that if the Cuban regime does not transform itself radically, all right, nothing is going to happen. Cuba, Castro is not Gorbachev. There is no glasnost here. There is no perestroika here. There is no economic restructuring, all right? In fact, it's an agreement for nothing here. Cuba is a stubborn regime. They have to listen to what Castro says and what he says in Spanish. He's stubborn, will not give up.
Yeah. Well, they don't seem to have any need to give up. The Obama administration has essentially given them carte blanche, it appears, exacting very little, if anything, in return for this enormous concession.
Frank, that is exactly that. It announced the status of Cuba when Cuba doesn't even deserve it, without demanding almost anything in return, Frank.
Indeed. Luis Fleischman is our guest. Dr. Fleischman is a senior advisor to the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project at the Center for Security Policy, the editor of its Americas report, and the author most recently of Latin America in the Post-Chavez Era, the Security Threat to the United States. And let me turn to the subject of that book of yours, Luis. You've touched on this already a bit, but what does this deal for the Cuban regime mean, if anything, for Venezuela? And the president signed yesterday sanctions legislation on some members of the Venezuelan elite close to that regime. Is there a complete incomprehensible, incoherent disconnect at work here?
Well, I think there are a couple of positive things. First of all, I welcome the signing of those sanctions because I think it is important to sanction Venezuela. On the one hand, I think he made a clear separation between Cuba and Venezuela, and that's good. That means Castro, I don't know whether Castro requested Obama not to sign the sanctions bill, but the reality is that Obama didn't sign it. But on the other hand, Obama's attitude toward Cuba, namely giving up without getting anything in return except this prisoners exchange, is a clear sign to not only to Venezuela, but also its allies in the continent, namely Ecuador, Nicaragua, and Bolivia, that our administration is willing to be soft and is willing to accommodate to the wishes of Latin American countries, and that is not, and that the human rights agenda and the security agenda are not priority. So that is my reading of that. Like Maduro, maybe Maduro can understand this. Okay, he cannot lift the sanctions right now, but maybe in the future, after what we have seen with Raúl Castro, maybe he's going to be softer on us. So I believe that the message has come. The Cuba move, the message has been sent that that the United States is not willing to go tough on these countries that not only are tough on their own people, they also are a danger to our security.
Deeply hostile to us, indeed. Luis Fleischmann, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for your time and your expertise on these matters. This is an incredibly important time, especially if, as I fear, we're likely to see the Cuban model of Obama's foreign policy applied shortly to Iran, which is also, as you've documented at the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project and the Americas report, a mortal threat to us in our own hemisphere. Luis, keep up the good work and come back to us again very soon. We look forward to talking with you. Next up, courageous anti-jihadist Muslim Zudi Jasser joins us to talk about our cluelessness about the true nature of the war for the free world. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Three things are clear following North Korean hackers' cyber attack on Sony Pictures over its new film, The Interview. First, that country's despotic ruler, Kim Jong-un, has no sense of humor, especially when he's the butt of the joke. Second, even desperately poor third world countries now have access to asymmetric warfare techniques that enable them to threaten or even to attack the assets of the most powerful of nations. And third, disclosing embarrassing emails and divulging proprietary information is nothing compared to what such cyber war can inflict. We are now on notice that Russia, China, and Iran, all allies and enablers of North Korea, have the ability to penetrate, manipulate, and possibly destroy our electric grid. Protecting our critical infrastructure and punishing North Korea should be two of our top priorities. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm thrilled to say, joined by a man I consider an exemplar of patriotism, courage, and the sort of Muslim activist that we need a lot more of in this country. He is Dr. Zudi Jasser, a medical doctor by training and profession, but in his spare time, he mounts a very heroic effort to try to help give voice to the views and the aspirations of Muslims who don't seek to impose their co-religionists' jihadist ambitions on the rest of us. He serves as the president and founder of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. He is the author of a best-selling book, A Battle for the Soul of Islam, An American Muslim Patriot's Fight to Save His Faith. He is a former lieutenant commander in the United States Navy and is currently a member of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. And I know the views that he is about to express are his own. We're very grateful to him for coming to express them. Zudi Jasser, welcome. It's always a great treat to have you with us.
Likewise, Frank. It's just great to be with you again.
Let's start with sort of your appreciation, Zudi, of what we're up against in what I call the war for the free world. There is a notion that we confront, aside from the odd terrorist group, whether it's Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State overseas, primarily lone wolves in this country, Australia, you know, and elsewhere. What is your estimation of whether there is something larger afoot here, or whether these are just simply, as we're told, self-radicalized individuals, but they really have nothing to do with anything else?
Well, I can't tell you how dangerous this concept of lone wolf is, as if these guys come out of thin air, and they aren't self-radicalized. It's all part of a common manifestation of political Islam and its desire to take domination over all non-Islamic states. And These militant varieties are simply individuals that decide to be militarized and take it on their own to act out. So whether it's in Australia or Oklahoma or Ottawa or London, these are all individuals with a common disease. And, you know, I would liken it to the Ebola virus. I mean, it spreads, has common origin, will replicate. You could have a global pandemic, and that's what we're seeing in radical Islam, in that it's a symptom of a deeper, more malignant global ideology, which is related. Boko Haram means Western education is a sin. It's exactly similar to the ideology in Pakistan, which killed almost 150 kids, even though, you know, it's a Pakistani version of the same type of ideology. And to separate those out makes us anesthetized to treating the real central ideology of political Islam.
Let me drill down on that, because I couldn't agree with you more. There are, of course, different ways of describing this political ideology. I think your, as a medical doctor, your analogy to a global pandemic is apt. But again, diagnosing the disease is critical. Its adherents typically call it Sharia. And while I appreciate that there are lots of Muslims who follow their faith in a way that they believe is consistent with Sharia, but not perhaps the one espoused by, endorsed, and directed by the authorities of Islam, how would you characterize the ideological character of what we're facing here, Dr. Zudi Jasser?
Well, the characterization is the mixture of Islam with the state, or Islamo-patriotism. The common element of those who seek the caliphate, or jihadists who seek terrorism, who hate the West, is they believe in the patriotic adherence to the Islamic State. The instrument of the Islamic State is Sharia. However, to say that all Sharia is evil, certainly there's personal pietistic Sharia, which I don't believe, just as any religious practice is not a threat to the state. Governmental Sharia is certainly a threat, and I think to engage Muslims, as we saw with the millions that went to the street to reject the Brotherhood, that tried to reject the Khomeinists in the 2009 Green Revolution, those are Muslims who have a version of Sharia that they practice, but certainly don't want it in government, versus what they unite behind is a complete rejection of Islamo-patriotism, jihad, caliphism, and the Islamic State.
This brings us to what I wanted to visit with you particularly about, because as a leader of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, you are trying to advance a peaceable, tolerant Islam and reject what is being done, if not through violent means in countries like our own, through a kind of, well, I think of it as pre-violent technique. The Muslim Brotherhood calls it civilization jihad. In addition to these adherents to this political ideology of Sharia, you have this other subversive element taking place in many Western countries. What would you want non-Muslims to know and understand about not only the threat that the Brotherhood and its ilk represent to us, but also to their co-religionists like yourself?
Well, the bottom line is that if we continue to treat symptoms, we're not going to understand what the central ideology is. And there are many Muslim organizations in America that are part of that global hegemonization and believing in the Islamic State. And while they disagree with Al-Qaeda and the militancy of these so-called lone wolves, they're part of the pack. They're part of that wolf pack. And they believe in a second-class status for Western secularism. They don't adhere to the exceptionalism of American constitutional law, and ultimately they will give you bromides about how the Islamic State is not a big deal and it's not a threat, etc. All the while, it deflects us from dealing with the core ideologies and confronting them on the fact that it's not just so-called violent extremism, but that violent extremism is a means to an end. And unless they reject that end of the caliphate and the Islamic State, I mean, if you look, there was a letter to Baghdadi that 150 imams in America and Europe signed. That's a list of the Brotherhood in the West. Those imams wrote that letter because the Baghdadi ISIS types exposed the radicalism of the Islamic State for all Muslims, and ultimately they said, well, this is how you do a caliphate. You know, Mr. Baghdadi, you're doing it wrong. It should be X, Y, and Z. The jihad should be done X, Y, and Z. And yet moderate Muslims reject any caliphate. And that's what the West is missing, is the civilizational jihad is, look at that letter to realize what the civilizational jihad is. It's to say that, well, the Islamic State can be done in a moderate way. which any anti-theocrat would know cannot be.
Yeah, it is simply different means to the same end, which is this imposition of, second-class status doesn't really even begin to describe what is expected. And in that regard, Zudi Jasser, your reference to Bakr al-Badi, the leader of this Islamic State outfit, they have promulgated, as you know, a handbook on how to treat female captives and slaves, you know, infidels, and it ain't pretty, that's for sure. Let me turn to one other topic that I know you've wrestled with, Zudi Jasser, as you've sought to speak truth to power, both as a member of the very highly regarded U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and that is resisting efforts to restrict our freedom of speech by imposing what I guess is best described as Sharia blasphemy laws. Talk, if you would, a bit about what this episode with Sony Pictures and an apparent attack by the North Korean government on a private sector entity with effects on the release of the film and so on might mean for others trying to shut down works of art or you know, movies or what have you that are deemed to be offensive to Islam.
Well, I can't tell you how important this is to see a multi-million dollar corporation shut down the release of a $45 million film simply because of a threat from abroad. To see our government basically capitulate to that is a much bigger issue than simply North Korea. This is, you know, for people who say, where are the voices of moderate Muslims? You know, I've been threatened on Twitter by folks from Sharia for Australia who threatened to kill me and others, and when I pushed back and contacted the Bureau, they said, well, we can't do anything because these guys are in Australia, et cetera, and basically we still push along because if we don't speak out, this will become a clash of civilizations and Americans will not know what the solution is. So, you know, when countries like North Korea do this, I would ask people, look at the Syrian Electronic Army. In assistance with Russia, they shut down the New York Times, the Washington Post. I mean, they've been attacking us on social media and else for years, and yet it's part of the war.
Yeah, it's a new aspect of the battle space in the war for the free world. Zudi Jasser, the author of A Battle for the Soul of Islam and American Muslim Patriots Fight to Save His Faith. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your work at the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. I hope you will come back to us maybe for a full hour soon to discuss these matters in greater detail. Next up, Bill Roggio will get us his take on what happened in Pakistan. Another manifestation of this global jihad. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined as we have the privilege of being most weeks by Bill Roggio, the managing editor of an extraordinarily important online resource, the Long War Journal. It is a project of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where Bill is a senior fellow. He is a former combat veteran. He is a man who has been embedded with our own forces and others in recent years, and he is monitoring, chronicling, and helping us all understand what is going on around the world as part of what I think of as the war for the free world. Bill, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Always a pleasure.
Well, there's so much to talk about, Bill. I guess I'd start with the horror of what was unleashed in Peshawar at a public school for children of army officers by the Taliban. We've talked about this outfit for some time. I take it this is the Taliban that the Pakistani military considers the bad Taliban as opposed to the good Taliban that they have been supporting and enabling for many years. But help us understand who the players are and what to make of this barbaric act.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Frank. This was executed by the quote-unquote bad Taliban. Let me clarify that. So the Pakistani state, as we all know by now, sponsors jihadist groups. They like to use them for as proxies for against India, Afghanistan, the United States to further their foreign policy goals. And there's true believers within the government and within the military as well that adhere to the jihadist worldview. But to groups like the movement of the Taliban in Pakistan, which is the group that executed this attack, they're considered bad Taliban only because the Pakistani state and is not it doesn't follow. It's not on board with being global jihadist, right? The Pakistani state is far more subtle in what they want. So the movement of the Taliban in Pakistan and other groups like Islamic Movement, Uzbekistan, Al-Qaeda, whatnot, these groups are considered bad Taliban only because they want to wage war against the Pakistani state. If they would change their mind and say, hey, we're no longer going to conduct attacks inside Pakistan, if they did that tomorrow, they'd be good Taliban again. So they executed this attack in Peshawar. It was horrific. Look, they were clearly sent in there to kill everyone in their path, and they just about achieved that mission. This was the tales of the survivors makes that very clear. This should come as no surprise. This group has executed numerous attacks against civilians and churches, mosques, schools, hospitals, and markets, and at hotels. So they're constantly out to kill civilians. I think in this case, the purpose, I've seen media analysis saying, oh, well, this just shows how weak they are because they're hitting a soft target. That's nonsense. They've been hitting soft targets since their inception. They have purposes for those attacks. In this case, I think it's to intimidate and deter individuals either from joining the military and letting them know your families can be next if you continue to cooperate.
Let me just pick up on something you said, Bill Roggio, because I wonder whether, in point of fact, the Pakistani government and the Taliban elements that they support, or for that matter, other jihadist elements they support, are really not engaged in a global jihad. There was a brigadier by the name of S.K. Malik, who was prominent in the Pakistani armed forces. Back in 1979, he wrote a book, as I'm sure you know, The Quranic Concept of War, which no less than Zia-ul-Huq, the former general and president of Pakistan, who I guess was as responsible as any single person for turning it into an Islamist state. This Quranic concept of war was all about global jihad. And I just wonder, is this really basically just focusing on the jihad in the neighborhood for the moment, Bill, but they're of a mind with the rest of the global jihadists that their objective ultimately is securing the triumph of Sharia worldwide?
Right, and the difference with groups like the movement of the Taliban in Pakistan is that they're not doing it quick enough. It's almost like the reason why Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood have differences at points in times. It's because the Muslim Brotherhood's willing to say, you know, we'll do the democracy thing one time, do a one and done on democracy, where Al-Qaeda is saying, hey, we need to fight for this. You know, the way it's done is through the sword, not through the ballot box. It's that kind of difference. I mean, the reality is the Pakistani state is one of, to me, next to Iran, they're the two biggest state sponsors of terrorism.
And a nuclear-armed state at that, which is a pretty scary proposition. Bill, let me turn quickly to another manifestation of the global jihad this week, of course, and that is the incident in Sydney, Australia. What do you make of the fact that this fellow was known to be a jihadist, a dangerous and, in fact, a violent one, and yet was allowed to run loose and then perpetrated this act of violence on behalf of, he says, the Islamic State?
You know, I mean, it's two things, too. He's not just known to be a jihadist. He's also known to be a criminal. I think this is just a major problem in Western world where guys who commit crimes, you know, are walking the street still. I mean, they're accused of rape and other crimes. But then, you know, is espousing radical jihadist views under surveillance and yet is still able to execute these attacks. It just goes to show that we still, 13 years after, we haven't been able to grapple with this. Is the guy connected to the Islamic State directly? Everyone's dismissed the possibility. I think we need more time to find out whether there were any links. He seems to be a bit nutty.
But Bill, this really isn't the point, is it? I mean, this idea that you have to prove that he's a card-carrying member of the Islamic State,
He is, well, even the prime minister, who seemed to go to some lengths to deny the connection to Islam, called it a death cult. And these guys are all connected by the ideology. And that's the point that I think we keep missing.
You're absolutely. It's like when Major Nidal Hassan killed 13 soldiers and we wanted to call it a work accident.
And the guy who beheads the grandmother in Moore, Oklahoma, and we call it workplace violence. I mean, these are things that are connected in the most fundamental sense in that they are inspired and promulgated on behalf of Sharia. Let me turn to this backdrop, Bill. We've not had a chance, I think, to talk to you since the United States Senate, at least the Democratic majority thereof on the outgoing Intelligence Committee, decried the use of enhanced interrogation techniques. I'd like your thoughts on both the report and its findings at a moment when we are clearly still very much engaged with these folks and need, if anything, I would argue, more and better intelligence as to what they're up to.
Yeah, look, I think the report was disingenuous. I think it's a political attack, again, and as well as an attack against the CIA, which I have a lot of problems with, by the way. I think we should have a debate on, you know, how, what is torture, what is enhanced interrogations, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I have a question here. Why is it we still can't see pictures of Osama bin Laden or read documents that are, that were seized from his compound that are 20 or 30 years old, and yet those supposedly will harm national security, and yet detailing how we conduct interrogations in a detailed report doesn't hurt national security? I don't understand that one at all. I think this is extremely harmful, releasing the report in the manner that it was done. And, you know, look, I've read the summary. I have questions about some of those methods, whether they're viable or whether we should even be doing that. But the way this was handled was completely inappropriate. This is the kind of thing that needs to be fixed internally. Unfortunately, it's been used, in my opinion, to continue to lambast the Bush regime, which I, again, have problems with the way they conducted themselves in the war on terror, and as well as to attack the CIA.
Yeah, all of that's clearly the backstory to this very problematic report, Bill Roggio. But I think we can agree that we're going to need more interrogations, maybe not of this kind, but we're doing less and less of it at a moment. That capability seems to me to be critically important. I'm out of time, I'm afraid, my friend. We've got to go. I appreciate so much what you do at the Long War Journal and our visits each week. We look forward to doing much more of it in 2015 and wish you and your family the best. Next up, one of Judicial Watch's top experts, Chris Farrell, joins us to talk about the insecurity of our border and what it means for you. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
One of the great things about being able to do this program is the chance to visit with people that I admire greatly, both as members of really extraordinarily important organizations and for the work they do in their own right. One such individual is Chris Farrell. He is today the Director of Investigations and Research at a truly indispensable organization, Judicial Watch. Chris has a long and distinguished history of service to our country. Before coming to Judicial Watch, among other things, he was an Army counterintelligence and human case officer, and we will be drawing on some of that background in the course of this conversation. Chris Farrell, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I am privileged to have you as a friend and colleague and to have you as a guest with us today.
Great to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
One of the many things that Judicial Watch has been really pathbreaking on is trying to help the rest of us understand the magnitude of the physical security threat to this country that is associated with an open border. You've done reporting on the presence of the Islamic State in Mexican cities adjacent to our border and perhaps now across it. You've been warning about Al-Qaeda operatives coming and going. You've been making clear that at the moment that deportations are now at a negligible level, the number of illegal border crossings in the wake of the president's amnesty are skyrocketing. Give us a flavor of what all this means in terms of the safety and security of the American people.
I think the best example is anecdotal, and it's from a Texas DPS, or the essentially the state police officer I spoke with just this last week, who had returned from the border a couple of days ago. They were picking up people who were clearly illegal aliens who had just crossed, trying to turn them over to the Border Patrol. The Border Patrol would not take them. And in instances where the Border Patrol were processing people at their stations, their biggest concern was getting them a bus ticket to where they wanted to go.
It is hard to imagine a more dramatic form of magnet, really, to bring more of these folks across the border as word of that kind of treatment leaches out. Is this because the Border Patrol is now completely disengaged from its mission of protecting and securing that border?
Correct. I mean, there is no longer an enforcement role. They are facilitators for resettlement. That's what their mission now is. And so people that are apprehended and are processed are really, their first question is, well, where do you want to go? Where do you have a relative? They're given a notice to appear for 2 years from the date of apprehension. And then the biggest issue to tackle is getting them their Greyhound bus ticket to go to Chicago or L.A. or wherever they choose to go.
And in short order, presumably, some kind of documentation that makes it possible for them to be here legally, at least if the sort of thrust of the president's executive amnesty is followed to its logical conclusion. I know he said that, you weren't supposed to have this apply to people who are coming here now. But as a practical matter, Chris Farrell, based on your experience and just common sense, is that likely to be how this works out, that even those coming now or those coming in the future will find their way into our social security and other social safety net?
Your description is a virtual guarantee. It's a lock. There's no enforcement. There's no checking. There's no clear establishment even of identity. Whoever shows up is whoever they say they are.
Which has implications, of course, for security in the first order, because as you've done so much to document, Chris, some of these are people who are coming here not for economic opportunity, but for criminal or perhaps even terrorist purposes. And Chris, you work with lawyers day in and day out at Judicial Watch. Talk, if you would, about whether the president's conduct in this regard, I mean, for example, standing down effectively, if not directly, the Border Patrol, is something that could be done without congressional direction and statutory authority.
Yeah, this is where there's a real point of contention, because of course the president enjoys extraordinary discretionary authority, but there's a difference between the discretionary authority of implementing or enforcing various policies and the difference of simply not following the law. And they're two different things. And of course, when someone operates outside the law in their official capacity, it's referred to as an ultra vires act. They're operating outside the scope of their authority. That's a tough nut to crack when you're the president, because he does enjoy broad executive privileges and authority. But what he's done is so far beyond the pale. He's not sort of doing gradations of enforcement. There's an abrogation here. There's a walking away from the actual lawful responsibility to enforce the law altogether. And that's what's most egregious.
Let me turn to another egregious issue, Chris Farrell, drawing upon your expertise, as I mentioned, as a former Army intelligence officer, in fact, a counterintelligence officer by training, and case officer, meaning that you had firsthand experience with and
practice of interrogations. What did you make of this recent report by the majority of the Senate Intelligence Committee and its conclusions about enhanced interrogation techniques?
I think former Vice President Cheney summed it up nicely by calling it crap. It's a political document intended for political operatives to attempt to jam or skewer the intelligence community and those folks sort of retroactively going back against those folks who are given assurances and promises that what they were doing was lawful and correct. It also undermines current ongoing operations and activities because it raises doubts and questions with our allies and our colleagues. It puts folks who are out currently engaged with the enemy in a very awkward position where they're looking over their shoulder and second-guessing whether their country is really with them or not.
And Chris, how important in the future might even it be that we be able to use some of these enhanced interrogation techniques, if not all of them, at least some of them? And also, you know, does this constitute torture in your estimation?
It does not constitute torture, number one. And then, you know, of all the various ints, right, the different intelligence fields, whether it's communications intelligence, imagery intelligence, et cetera, in my opinion, human intelligence, HUMINT, is the most valuable of all because HUMINT gives you intentions. All the other intelligence fields give you capabilities, but nobody can climb in the head of another person except an interrogator or a human intelligence case officer or counterintelligence officer because they deal with human beings. They interact, they talk, they debrief. And so there's an ability there to ascertain intentions, which is the most critical piece of all, because everyone has capability, but what are you going to do with it? That's what we're always looking for. So the ability to get inside the thinking of the opponent is absolutely critical, particularly with terrorism and asymmetrical warfare, where it's much more, there's the violent act itself, but there's the mind game component of it. There's the threat and intimidation aspect of it that causes countries to turn themselves inside out and change their laws and their behaviors just based on the threat of something happening. So it's critical.
It is critical, and unfortunately, it seems as though it's going to be less and less practiced, at least if this government has its way. And as you've said, Chris Farrell, you know from firsthand experience that especially when you're dealing with organizations that pride themselves on operational security, this may be the only hope you have of understanding not only intentions, frankly, but perhaps even capabilities. Chris Farrell, again, our guest, Director of Investigations and Research at the incalculably important Judicial Watch. I salute you for the work you're doing, Chris, and that you've done in the past. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. Merry Christmas to you and Happy New Year as well to all of our audience. And we look forward to talking with you again next week, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.